Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. This is I Am Resistance and the End Times. I hope this technology is working. I do not know, but we'll see. I am a voice in the darkness, a shadow, a human being, a slave. This talk I give to no one. There's something near and dear to my heart. Pain, suffering, despair, a life in logger time, camp time. I dedicate this talk to all those that have left us, all those that resist this toxic culture and living as a slave. Resist, resist, resist. All of my life I have felt this pain living here in disconnection. You know? I think we all experience that disconnection. And we feel it. We feel that disconnection with what we're taught to. We're taught from a very early age. I mean, we're brought into this camp of civilization, and from immediately we're being molded and, you know, into something as if we weren't already totally connected to all that is, and that we're taught this disconnection, mediated consciousness, right? Language, thinking that communication only comes from a thought system. We sense that we sense instinctively that we're being moved away from our instinct, and it's quite a painful experience, you know, I think. I remember some of it, you know. You know, it's a powerful thing. I have, among many, managed to traverse this camp. Somehow, I've learned the skills that are required to succeed, to flourish, to live in society, right? And I followed the paths that were provided for me, which there's few and far between, you know. I followed the rules, not always. I've rebelled, thinking that this was not for me, and I still think that. I saw that what was provided for me, the thoughts and all, was a lie, and I'd walked to that precipice many times in my youth, many, I don't know, enough to say, I don't know if I want to be here, you know? But I stayed. The despair has always been at the doorstep. Why is there this despair? Disconnection? Yes. But these explanations themselves are the source of despair, disconnection. The fact that we feel this emptiness, this psychology, this egocentrism, this being that is not itself one with all, right? So we have all these explanations from 10,000 plus years of civilization and language systems to tell us what is, always telling us what is. This is what is. These mediated consciousness, symbolic ideologies telling us this is what is. Yet we can't escape the what many have called that existential angst, that anxiety that I will call disconnection. You know, I experience it. And I think what we're seeing and what I myself have experienced is this just continuous amping up of brutality. It's just it's like a wave of it that just goes on and on, which is civilization. And recently, about a year and a half ago, I am what many call a father. Our society calls that. I'm a parent of children. And one of my children took his own life. It was inexplicable. This young boy of 16 would do that to himself. There was no real warning. And I knew him and he knew me. And he was loved and cared for and educated. And inexplicably, he blew his brains out in my backyard in early 2018. I can't make sense of it. There's no sense to make, but that's what I'm taught to do. That's how I grieve. I was grieving before his death, grieving this life, everyday life, right? The everyday life is what gets us. You read your Revolution of Everyday Life, Raoul Vergem. He shows us in 1968 what everyday life does to us in graphic detail. Fascinating. The tools of disconnection are powerful, and they're layered in thought and language, and it's just this, it's 5 million degrees of disconnection. And it brutalizes us. It lies to us constantly. And we're always left in this, well, what do I do? What do I do? We're trying to make sense in our little minds with using the narratives, constantly trying to make sense of things, needing a narrative, trying to stave off the disillusion. Forgive the dog barking in the background. Can't escape real life, right? This is no escape. And it's live, so enjoy. But maybe he'll be quiet. But it's, I have no explanation. I wasn't left a note. I was there with him the day before. I was there with him in the morning. And he was in this state of despair, but it wasn't, it was what I saw as just, he had an illness for that kind of, you know, like a bowel illness, like a real physical illness that, you know, but then something else happened. But I never for a moment thought he was truly suicidal, you know. I thought he was just, as all kids do, sadly, when they reach these past middle school ages or middle school itself, that 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, they, you know, in our culture, the culture of maximum harm, which is all of civilization, it's very, you know, they're in the indoctrination camps for 7+ hours a day, disconnected from their family, you know, taught, and just it's constant imposition of becoming. It's, and we see what it does to them and how they want to escape so terribly. They want to rebel. They jump into these video games to get away, as we do. They want to be distracted. They want to escape. We want to escape. But as children, we've made it so much more brutal to where that despair, the despair that we all feel, the despair that just coats our entire being in civilization. It just permeates every aspect, toxifies. And so recently, an article came out just a few days ago that really, and I've seen them periodically, the journalists are finally starting to see something. Of course, they don't see anything. They just regurgitate statistics and then go, oh, it's just depression, and blame neuropsychology. Oh, it's they're depressed. Sure. But we just say, oh, it's not the fact that everyday life murders us, mind, body, and soul, because mind, body, and soul don't exist. But I read this article because my son and my other children are victims of this. And so deaths of despair they talk about are young people dying from, you know, alcohol, drug abuse, and suicide, which alcohol and drugs are wonderful mediums for the living death, which is much of what it is to live in civilization, is the living death, no different than television. Television itself is a type of living death because we're just sitting in it sitting in front of it, watching it passively. Everything passive seems to really deal death. Passivity is a death dealer, right? Because it leaves us not feral, it leaves us brain damaged. Feral awakens us. It gets us to the immediate. But that's always just there in our instinct, but it's been bred out of us through the constant abuse of conditioning. So these deaths of despair, that what would we call despair? What is despair? It's far worse than mere hopelessness. That there's no hope. That I see that Maserati I might never have, so I fall to despair. Right? Which some would. The having orientation, as Eric Fromm would say. We live in the having orientation. So I am what I have. And if I can't have, then I can't be. Is that what happened to my sons? No, because this is something else. So what they say in this article, it's a Time magazine article, is that between 2007 and 2017, drug-related deaths increased 108% among adult ages 18 to 34, while alcohol-related deaths increased by 69% and suicides increased by 35%, according to the report, which drew on Centers for Disease Control and Prevention data. Altogether, about 36,000 millennials died deaths of despair. And in 2017, a fatal drug overdose being the biggest driver, because we're talking about the opioid crisis. Oh, yeah, sure. So the new federal estimates suggest that these rates will be starting to slow. Opioids and right? So they're like, oh, things are going to get better, right? Things are going to get better. The millennials are going to get better. The young people are going to get better because things are going to get better. But they're not. They're not. We can lie to ourselves and we can, you know, oh, if I'd have just seen the signs, I could have prevented my son. Or if we just saw the signs, but the signs are everywhere. As if the talking cure or happy drugs are going to do it. So they go to the other drugs. I myself love alcohol immensely. To what? I don't know. Obliterate myself. Sure. That's what I've become since my son's death. An alcoholic, a highly functioning alcoholic who aspires to do one-arm handstands and lives the movement culture. Anti-fragile, right? Despair surrounds us. and it always has, and it's penetrating deeper and deeper. And our fictions that we provide for the cattle, us, is the toxic is too high. They can't fend it off. And in the same sense, they don't care because it's designed to kill, right? Is it not? Julian Langer in Feral Iconoclasm speaks to suicide in an excellent chapter. The whole book is excellent. Everyone, please run out and get it. It's a Little Black Heart. And I got to talk to him about it a little bit. Young people commit suicide because they can't face the lies told to them through childhood. They arrive in the technosphere to be active parts of the mechanic body and contribute to production. They were promised that this would be a fulfilling experience, only to find an existential abyss. Adults commit suicide in the hope that those same lies are true. They hope that through death, they will arrive at the peace of heaven or a state of nothingness, where they will escape the geospatial and enter a transcendental void. These are the promises of civilization, theistic and atheistic, that life is death, is dead, and that in death there is peace. They put their faith in the promises of God. They put their faith in lies. These lies are the internalized script of civilization. They serve as the basis and moral justification of all civilization's production narratives. They keep the chained attached to their chains and the caged attached to their cages. End quote. Oh, Julian, you speak to me. So as those children, my child's children, he kills himself according to Julian because he can't face the lies. Though I tried to tell him the lies were lies, but as a parent, you're effed because there is no such thing as parenting. All you are is helping them be good slaves, helping them navigate the horror of the camp of civilization and filling their head with the narratives that you've been taught so that you can make it through the day as we trudge and grind through the Monday through Fridays to try to get to Saturday, to Sunday, and then back to the cesspool of everyday life. So we travel. So we have, that's how we stave off suicide. We drink and we travel and try to seek pleasure. We lie. We lie. We propagate lies. We turn ourselves off. Negative. No negative thoughts. We immerse ourselves in lies. We travel and we immerse ourselves in just all the stuff that we can do. We live through these mediums of media, of Facebook and the narrative. You know, we watch movies and everything is just about our next entertainment. We're constantly distracted. And if you give a morsel of truth to those lies, everybody stops and says, like, dude, that's deep. And then they blow you off and they have to, because that would create despair. I ask myself, and I'm taught to ask myself, am I responsible for the death of my son? And I say, yes, as a parent, I am responsible. I did not hurt him. I did not kill him. But I sowed the seeds, as all of us do. So therefore, I am responsible for all the deaths of all the children, all the young people. But in a sense, I'm not, because I'm only just a cog in the machine. So all of this faith I put in that lie is just that, a waste of time. I am no more responsible or not responsible for my son's death. What could I have done different? Oh, we all blah, 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 blah. That's all I've talked about in my mind for a year and a half of what I could have done differently. How I could have loved him differently. and how much pain I have experienced since his passing, since his brutal, violent death in my backyard. So you fall to despair. I have fallen to despair so many times, but this, you would say, would break the camel's back, right? That I fall to the deepest, the heights of despair, as an author calls it. I reach the heights of despair. And I found this book, Blessed is the Flame by Sarah Finsky, an introduction to the concentration camp. Concentration Camp Resistance and Anarcho-Nihilism. A wonderful, amazing book. And it's a small book that goes through what anarchy and nihilism. Anarchy is that attack on, order and structure. And nihilism is that sense that we're all fucked. Right? Because no one wants to believe that, because then what's the point? We fall right into that despair. Well, if there's no point, then why am I alive? And perhaps that's that point that Julian made, that's when we say, okay, well, here's my way out. I want some peace because I can get away from the thought. Or as a young person, I don't have to face the horror of this futurity. The author writes, when anarcho-nihilism urges us to abandon chronological modes, let me go back to that. What is a chronological mode? Chronology, like time. We work in three states of chronological awareness: despondency, I just talked about that, despair. Futurity, the belief, the hope, the faith in tomorrow, and a paralyzing suspension in the present. I've spent so many months with this because we, in recent years, have become a culture that wants to talk about mindfulness all the time. And I've used it in my work and practiced it for years now, mindfulness, to be present in a non-judgmental way is the basic idea of mindfulness. Be mindful, be present, right? You have the nine attitudes of mindfulness, beginner's mind, right? Gratitude. And there's a whole bunch, right? I can't remember all nine often. But the hardest of them is letting go. Letting go, right? Letting go of judgments, letting go of walking into a room and judging everything, letting go of the way we react to thought, the way that we want to be reactionary. Oh my God, did they just call me that? Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. That's like, oh my God is our call to action, but it's nothing. It's our call to be trolls on the internet. It's our call to be hyper-reactive. It's our call to be controlling and micromanaging, which I experience every day, as do you. So what happens is that that presentness that we create that's supposed to bring us peace actually is just another prison. It becomes that awareness of the present. Even in non-judgment, we become paralyzed by it. So it creates this fascinating way to survive. Right? For those who do not succumb to despair, the key to survival lay within the tension between logger time, that's camp time, and suicidal despondency. Suicidal despondency, which is really where we are, right? That suspension between the two. That is where most of us live. We're always on the precipice of suicidal despondency or back to this present, right? So now I'll watch this movie. Now I'll work out. Now I'll eat right. So then it's that back to it, right? Back to it. So then we survive, which that survival, as we learn in several books, but I'll just stick with Raoul Vigem's survival sickness. It's a sickness, because to survive is to not be alive. We think, oh, that's all our ancestors did was fight to survive. On the contrary, that's a narrative that we spin. And throughout civilization, we always say, well, it's better to survive with this. You need us. Civilization, you need civilization. Without us, you don't survive, because you wouldn't survive without us. We brought you here, right? But that's not true either. But that's what we believe. That's what the Hobbesian thesis, that life is outside of civilization, is nasty, brutish, and short. But it's actually the opposite, as we know. To live one with nature, this fantasy narrative, doesn't exist. But that's how we perceive it. But that's what we say. Oh, gosh, I could never do that. That's not for me. I can't fast. That's what people say to me all the time. They're like, feast and famine, and all we have is in the first world is feast, hence why we have obesity, and we're again the living dead, because we're, you know, 300 pounds of toxicity, and then we run to these peddlers of toxicity to cure us. And we see the horror, but we can't see that, because to see that is too painful. So they say a few manage to break this spell and enter into something much more fierce, as exemplified in the stories above, and there's so many stories of resistance. From the spectrum of despondency, suspension, and futurity, a rupture forms and reveals a space of insurrectionary possibilities. And that is pure, as they say, jouissance, which is rejoicing in our desperate act of total hopelessness of our situation. But we lash out. We lash out. We create what they talk about in this book is messianic time. We must derail the train and rupture history altogether, the creation of ruptures. That's what these authors reveal to us, and that's what we can see. Quote, when anarcho-nihilism urges us to abandon those chronological modes, I referenced this just a moment ago, it is in essence asking us to sever all ties to the continuation of society and work instead to negate its existence. In this rupture of time, we find a richness of life unimaginable within the existing order. Messianic time is the chronological awareness in which jouissance can flourish. For rather than deferring our rage to the future, we can finally realize that now is the time we've been waiting for. End quote. So in our defiance of everyday life, in that fight between despair and the present and the lie of futurity, we fight. And that's stark. And it doesn't make us feel good. And it's not ever supposed to. That's the what is. To study that, to embrace that insurrection from the inside out. And I spent so much time thinking about this, examining it, looking for ruptures. And this talk is a call for ruptures, is a rupture, is an attempt at possibility, an insurrectionary possibility of rupturing chronological time, lager time, because this is a concentration camp. No question. Fight for what you love. Until next time, I am resistance in the end times.